But no, the order was from Deepak, and it read, CAT scan of the head with and without contrast. Back in my room, and by noon, still no sign of Hema, or Stone, or Shiva. Amelia said they would be along presently. The physical therapist helped me stand beside my bed for a few seconds. My legs felt like jello sticks. I took a few steps with assistance, then sat in the chair, exhausted, woozy, as if I had run a marathon. I dozed there, ate what little I could. After lunch, I took a few more steps and even peed upright. The nurses helped me back to my bed. In retrospect, they seemed pleased to get out of my room. It was 2 p.m. when Thomas Stone appeared at my door. There were dark circles around his eyes. He sat self-consciously on the edge of the bed. He touched my hand. His lips parted. Wait, I said. Don't say anything yet. I looked out of the window at the clouds, at distant smokestacks. The world was intact now, but I knew once he spoke it wouldn't be so. Okay, I said. What happened to Shiva?
He had a massive bleed in his brain, he said, his voice hoarse. It happened last night, about an hour after we left your room. Hema was with him. He suddenly clutched his head in pain. Then, in a matter of seconds, he was unconscious.
Is he gone? Thomas Stone shook his head.
He bled from an arteriovenous malformation, a cavernous tangle of blood vessels in the cortex. He has probably had it all along. He was on anticoagulants for the blood clot in his arm. In a week we would have stopped.
Where is he?
Here, in the ICU, on a ventilator. Two neurosurgeons have seen him.
He shook his head.
It isn't feasible to evacuate the bleed. They think it's too late, and that he's brain dead.
I didn't register much of what he said after that. I remember he said that my CAT scan showed a similar but smaller spider knot of vessels, but mine wasn't bleeding. A miracle of sorts, I suppose, since I'd bled from everywhere till I got Shiva's liver. A few minutes later, Hema, Deepak, and Vinu came into the room. I understood now that Stone had been delegated to break the news. Poor Hema. I should have tried to comfort her, but I was too full of grief and guilt. I felt so very tired. They sat around my bed, Hema weeping, bent over, resting her head on my thigh. I wanted them to leave. I closed my eyes for a moment. I woke up when a nurse came in to silence one of the intravenous pumps. There was no one else in the room. I had her walk me to the bathroom, and then I sat in the armchair. I wanted my strength back. When I awoke, Thomas Stone was by my chair.
He can't breathe on his own, and there are no pupillary or other reflexes, he said in response to my silent query. He's brain dead now.
I said I wanted to see him. My father wheeled me down the hall where Shiva lay. Hema was with him, her eyes puffy and red, and when she turned to me, I felt ashamed to be alive, ashamed to be the cause of her sorrow. Shiva looked asleep. It was his turn to sport the spike coming out of his skull, the intracranial pressure monitor. The endotracheal tube skewed his lips, angling his chin up unnaturally. The rise and fall of his chest from the ventilator offered a spot on which to rest my eyes, and my ifs were coming in that rhythm. If I hadn't come to America. If I hadn't seen Sige. If I hadn't opened the door for Gennett. Hema wheeled me back to my room, helped me back in bed. I said to her, It would have been better if you and Shiva had buried me. You'd be on your way to missing now with your favorite son. It was a stupid, churlish thing to say, a primitive and subconscious urge to wound her so as to assuage my pain and guilt. But if I expected her to strike back, she didn't. There is a point when grief exceeds the human capacity to emote, and as a result, one is strangely composed. She had reached that point. Marian, I know you think I favored Shiva, and maybe I did. What can I say but that I'm sorry? A mother loves her children equally, but sometimes one child needs more help, more attention to get by in the world. Shiva needed that. Marian, I have to apologize to you for more than that. I thought you were responsible for Genet being mutilated, circumcised, and all that followed. I held that against you. When we came here, Shiva told me everything. My son, I hope you can forgive me. I'm a stupid mother. I was speechless at this news. What else had gone on when I was unconscious? Outside, a siren drew closer and closer, an ambulance coming to Our Lady. They want to discontinue the ventilator on Shiva, Emma said. I can't bear for them to do that. As long as he is breathing, even if it is the ventilator breathing for him, he's alive for me. The next morning, after the nurse seated me in the shower and helped me with my first bath, I put on a fresh gown and I asked to be wheeled to Shiva's room. Stop here, I said, well before his room, because I saw through the half-open door that Thomas Stone was seated by Shiva's bed, just as I was told he had sat by mine. His fingers rested on Shiva's wrist, feeling the pulse. His hand lingered there long after he had registered the heart rate. I wondered what he was thinking. I watched him for a full 10 minutes before he stood up and came out, his eyes haunted and red. He didn't see me as he walked off in the other direction. I rolled my chair after him. Dr. Stone, I said. Every fiber of my being wanted to cry out, Father. He came to me. Dr. Stone, I said. Surely an operation is his only chance. Can't the neurosurgeons go in, tie off the tangled vessels, and evacuate the clot in his brain? So what if it's a long shot? It's his only shot. He considered this for a while. Son, they say the tissue in there is, sorry to say this, the consistency of wet toilet paper. Blood mixed with brain. The pressure is so high, if they so much as touch him, they tell me it'll only make him bleed further. I didn't want to accept that. Can't you do it? You and Deepak? You've done burr holes, I've done burr holes. What's there to lose? Please, let's give him that chance. He waited so long that even I could hear the fallacy of what I was suggesting. My father put his hand on my shoulder. He spoke to me gently, as to a junior colleague, not to his son. Marian, remember the 11th commandment, he said. Thou shalt not operate on the day of a patient's death. When I was back in my room, Thomas Stone brought up Shiva's CAT scan. I was shocked to see the huge white splotch, which is how blood looks on a CAT scan, involving both hemispheres and spilling into the ventricles. It compressed the brain within the rigid confines of the skull. I knew then that it was hopeless. Because of the aneurysm or tangled vessel malformation in his brain, Shiva was not a potential donor for heart or kidneys, for fear there might be similar changes to those organs. Hema didn't want to be there when the ventilator was discontinued. I said I'd be with him. I asked to be alone with Shiva when he passed. Hema said her goodbye first. I was outside the room when Vinu escorted her out. It was a heartbreaking sight to see my mother,
the tail end of a sari draped over her head, her shoulders slumped, leave her still-breathing child. It must have felt to her as if she were abandoning him. Every eye in the unit was on her, and not one was dry, as her shimmering sari-clad form floated down the hall on her way to the quiet room. With Deepak's assistance, I climbed onto Shiva's bed. It was 8 in the evening. I settled myself next to him. Everything but his breathing tube and intravenous line had been removed. Deepak peeled away the tape that held the tracheal tube to Shiva's cheeks. Then, with a nod from me, he injected morphine through Shiva's intravenous tubing. If any part of Shiva's brain was alive, we didn't want it to sense pain, or fear, or suffocation. Deepak turned off the ventilator, silenced its immediate shrill protest, slid the endotracheal tube from Shiva's mouth, and then he left the room. I lay there, my head against Shiva's, a finger resting on his carotid pulse. His body was warm. He never took a breath after the tube came out. His facial expression never changed. His pulse stayed regular for almost a minute. Then it paused, as if it had just realized its lifelong partner, the lungs, had quit. His heart sped up, became faint, and then, with a final throb under my fingers, it was gone. I thought of Ghosh. Of all the pulse types, this was both the rarest and the most common. A Janus quality that every pulse possesses. The potential to be absent. I closed my eyes and clung to Shiva. I cradled him, his skull buttressed against mine and now wet with my tears. I felt physically vulnerable in a way I'd never felt when we were a continent apart. As if with his death, my own biology was now altered. The heat was rapidly leaving his body. I rocked Shiva, wedging my head against his, remembering how for so long I was unable to sleep except like this. I felt despair. I didn't want to leave this bed. Chang and Eng had died within hours of each other, because when the healthy one was offered the opportunity to be freed from the dead one, he declined. I understood so well. Let Deepak give me a lethal dose of morphine, and let my life end this way. Let my respiration cease, my pulse fade and then disappear. Let my brother and me leave the world in the same embrace with which we began in the womb. I pictured Shiva getting the telegram, his coming to me, then putting himself at risk to save me. Would I have done the same for him? Perhaps when he saw me, he'd felt the way I did now, that it didn't matter what might have transpired between us, but life would not be worth living and would end soon if something happened to the other. His body continued to lose heat in my arms, as if I were drawing it away, siphoning it over. I remembered the two of us running up the hill in a relay, carrying a lifeless and cold child to casualty, the parents trailing behind us. He was now that lifeless child. The minutes passed. Ultimately, it was the rude coldness of Shiva's skin, the terrible separation it delineated of the living and the dead, the disarticulation of our bound flesh, that forced me to a new understanding, a new way of seeing us in the face of such rapid attrition. And this is what I came to. Shiva and I were one being. Shiva Marion. Even when an ocean separated us, even when we thought we were two, we were Shiva Marion. He was the rake and I the erstwhile virgin. He the genius who acquired knowledge effortlessly while I toiled into the night for the same mastery. He the famous fistula surgeon, and I just another trauma surgeon. Had we switched roles, it wouldn't have mattered one bit to the universe. Fate and Genet had conspired to kill my liver,
but Shiva had a role in Genet's fate, and hence my fate. Every action of ours turned out to be dependent on the other. But now, by a brilliant and daring rearrangement of organs, Shivamarian had readjusted. Four legs, four arms, four kidneys, and so on. But instead of two livers, we had downsized to one. Then karma and bad luck took us even further, forced further concessions. We lost ground on his side. A few organs died. Okay, just about everything on his side died. But we retained half his liver, and it was thriving. What we had to do now was economize further, go halves again. Tough measures for tough times. Two legs sufficed, so also with eyes, kidneys. We'd go with half a liver, one heart, one pancreas, two arms. But we were still Shivamarian. Shiva lives in me. Call it a far-fetched scheme that I conjured up to allow me to go on. Well then, it allowed me to go on. It gave me comfort. It dried my tears, helped me untwine my arms and legs from the body that we were discarding. In the eerie quiet of that room, so primed for machines, but with the machines all silent, the blinds closed, and with an icy corpse next to me, I felt Shiva was instructing me. He had rowed over from the sinking ship, and he was telling me to think this way, and it was just Shiva's kind of logic. One being at birth, rudely separated, we are one again. They were assembled outside. A ghoulish receiving line was what I thought at first. But they couldn't know what had just transpired, and so I didn't blame them. Their hearts were in the right place. Thomas Stone, Deepak, Vinu, and so many of my nurses and nursing assistants, my friends, my Our Lady family before they became my caregivers. I shook each hand and thanked them for the two of us. I believe they will tell you my manner was composed, far different from what they expected. I left Thomas Stone for last. After I shook his hand, I followed an irrational instinct, Shiva's, I believe, certainly not mine, which told me to hug him, not to get, but to give. To let him know that as a father it turns out he'd done what he was meant to do. He lived on in us, and we lived because of his skills. The way he clung to me, held me as if he were drowning, told me I'd made the right choice, or Shiva had, awkward as it was. I walked slowly down the hall to our quiet room, a euphemism for the place we chose to give bad news, a place with chairs, a table, a sofa, a big picture window, a cross on the wall, but no TV, no magazines, only a solid and soundproof door. How many times had I made this walk as a trauma surgeon? So often I had lingered outside the door, conscious of the devastation my news would be bringing. Had I honored the feelings and the dignity of those who waited in that room? The parents, siblings, spouses, and children, even if what I had to say dashed all their prayers? I could remember every such encounter. I could recall each face as it turned in hope and apprehension when the door opened. I found Hema, hands crossed in front of her, gazing out of the window at the lights of the battleship housing project that abutted our house staff quarters, and the distant outline of the bridge beyond. Her back was to me. She saw my reflection in the glass before she saw me. But unlike every single person I had ever come to see in this room, she did not spin around. Instead, she stood like a statue, staring at my reflection in the window. I stopped where I was, holding the door open. I saw in that glass her eyes widen, the eyebrows rise. She held my gaze for the longest time. Her face showed surprise, as if who she saw wasn't the person she had expected to see. Here we are, Ma, I said. She cocked her head at my voice. She brought one hand up to her chin, her fingers aligned and locked together and resting contemplatively along her cheek, her movements exaggerated. She studied my face, my reflection, just like a village girl who is surprised in the act of drawing water at the well, and who must now read the intentions of the tall, smiling avatar whom she sees standing behind her. Then, in slow motion, as if this were a dance, and both of us dancers, she turned and faced me. I moved to her. Here we are, I said again, my arms extending toward her. We can go home now, Ma. It must have seemed to her a very strange thing, even the wrong thing, to say. To live purely in the here and now, to look forward, but never to the past. That was vintage Shiva. Here we are, I said. She came into my arms. We held her tight. Chapter 53. She is coming. On a beautiful morning, just 3 weeks after Shiva's transference, Hema and I took leave of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor. Thomas Stone insisted on being our escort. We stepped outside into air so crisp I felt a cough or a sneeze would shatter it like glass. The brick facade of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor glistened with dew as we said our goodbyes. The hospital's recent turn in the limelight had brought in special city funds and sparked emergency repairs. As a result, the Monsignor in the fountain was no longer tilting. His swizzle stick was gone, as was his crusting of bird droppings. Polished and sanguine, he looked emasculated and alien to the place where I had spent the last 7 years of my life. Our yellow cab sped across the Whitestone Bridge to Kennedy Airport. The sun had barely come up, and yet the freeway was thick with cars, the solitary drivers insulated from one another in wafer-thin metal, which at these speeds offered only the illusion of protection. We merged like wingmen rejoining the formation. Hema looked out meditatively, just as I had when I arrived 7 years before. I wondered if she could hear the hum of the uber-consciousness, the superorganism who kept this from descending into chaos. The year 1986 was a disaster for our family. Hema believed that it had something to do with the number, because it had birth in the one and destiny in the eight. 1986 had started off terribly with the Challenger spacecraft exploding on January 28th, which was month one, and there was the number eight again. Then the Chernobyl tragedy was exactly 88 days after the Challenger disaster. On that scale, the death of one twin, on the 18th of the month, hardly registered. There was yet another death 8 days later that had bearing on us. My neighbor, Holmes, came with Appleby of the detective agency to let me know that Gennett had passed away in a prison hospital in Galveston just as I was regaining my strength. Gennett's son had been adopted by a family in Texas, and she had gone in search of him. She'd been living hand-to-mouth in a cardboard lean-to a few blocks from the seawall when she was picked up. She was a mere skeleton and survived just 2 days in the prison infirmary. She had supposedly died of adrenal failure caused by tuberculosis. I knew better. She had died chasing greatness, and never saw it each time it was in her hand. So she kept seeking it elsewhere, but never understood the work required to get it or to keep it. I'm ashamed to say I felt relief when the word came. Only her death could ensure that we didn't keep tearing each other apart for what remained of our lives. In the international departure hall, I heard snatches of Bengali, Arabic, and Tagalog. A man bound for Lagos protested in screeching pigeon about the unfairness of British Airways because there was no way he was 4 pounds over. In this setting, Thomas Stone, without his white coat or scrubs, looked like the newly arrived foreigner.
"Will you be back, Marion?"
he asked when it was time for saying goodbye.
All I knew was that I wanted to be with Hema when she interred Shiva's ashes between Ghosh and Sister Mary Joseph Braise. The grotto by Missing's back wall and an earshot of the little creek was rapidly becoming the family burial plot. I was going back also to see Matron, Almaz, and Gibru. I knew that my presence would help console them. Beyond that, I hadn't given great thought to my future. "Of course I'll be back," I said. "I still have my house, my car, my job."
"Be careful what you eat, drink," he said.
It was his way of telling me to protect his handiwork. I felt better than well. Other transplant patients had to fight to keep their bodies from rejecting the life-saving organ. The cortisone they took led to cataracts, diabetes, hip fractures, and other side effects. I was blessed not to have to swallow a single pill. I felt no pain if you didn't count the twinges under my ribs, which I considered promising and not painful. They were the sign of Shiva's half-liver growing to fully occupy its new home.
"How about you?"
I had yet to find a comfortable way to address my father. It was Dr. Stone in the hospital, and nothing at times like this.
"Will you have a job to go back to?" I teased.
He hadn't seen Boston since I fell ill. His slow smile only exaggerated the sadness in his face. He took Shiva's death personally, as if fate had never forgotten that he'd once attempted to destroy Shiva, and so when he had operated to save Shiva, his original intent had betrayed him. My father made no attempt to shake my hand. Our one hug after Shiva's passing was good for a lifetime. We parted with a nod. Hema, however, took Thomas Stone's hands in both of hers. I had missed their reunion at my bedside. Now I watched like a nosy child.
"Thomas, stop this at once," Hema said, chiding him for his melancholic expression. "You did everything you could, do you hear me? You did your best for your sons. No one else in the world could have done what you did. Thomas, if Ghosh were here, he'd say the same thing. He'd have been so proud of you, and he'd say go on with your work, because it is so important."
She released his hand after patting it one last time. Then she turned and walked away. Later, as our plane banked over Queens and headed for open water, I thought about Hamer's parting words to Stone. Buried in there had been her apology for having fashioned him into a monster in her mind for all these years. In patting his hand and walking away, she was releasing herself. Alitalia took us to Rome. Mechanical problems on the connecting flight had the agent projecting a 14-hour layover. It gave me an idea. In no time, Hema and I were once again in a taxi on a freeway, but this time we were heading to downtown Rome. We were like children playing hooky from school. Hema had needed little convincing. We went to a first-class hotel, the Hustler, Rome's best, I was once told. It was a grand building that overlooked the Spanish Steps. From the rooftop at dusk, the sky's red hue outlined the dome of St. Peter's in the distance. Each morning we set out for the briefest sightseeing. We returned to our hotel for lunch and a long afternoon nap. The evenings we wandered down the streets and alleyways beneath the Spanish Steps. Eventually, we'd pick an outdoor cafe for dinner.
"It's so familiar, isn't it?" Hema said. "These menus, typed out and mimeographed, minestrone and pasta vigioli, the waiters with white shirts, black pants, white aprons."
I knew what she meant. The Italians had brought it all to Ethiopia, right down to the umbrellas that hung over the little formica-topped round tables. Hema's face at dinner was as tranquil as I'd seen it since I became conscious of her at my bedside at Our Lady.
"I wish Ghosh could have been with us. How he would have enjoyed this," she said, smiling.
On the fourth morning, we let the concierge talk us into a private tour with a guide from our hotel.
"What did we want to see?"
"Surprise us," we said. Take us off the cow path. Places where there isn't too much walking or waiting in line. He began with the Santa Maria della Vittoria, a 10-minute ride from our hotel. It was a homely church, sitting right on the street, cars passing by, the elaborate facade looking as if it had been slapped onto the front of an unadorned stone box. Our guide said it was built about 1624, first dedicated to St. Paul and later to the Virgin Mary. The interior was small, tiny when compared with St. Peter's, with a short nave under a low vault. Off to the side, Corinthian pillars flattened into the wall demarcated three chapels which were nothing more than recesses, each with a rail for private prayer and a place to light candles. As we came to the end of the nave, our guide turned to the left and pointed.
"This is the Cornaro Chapel. It is what I wanted you to see," he said.
It took a few seconds for my eyes to relay the sight to my brain, and longer still for my brain to believe. The blue marble sculpture floating before me was Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. I wanted to silence our guide and say, "Stop, I know this sculpture." But in truth, what I knew was only a print that found its way onto a calendar which my mother had then thumbtacked to the wall of the autoclave room. It had been up for perhaps 30 years before Gauche had taken that aging piece of paper and framed it for me, to protect it from further deterioration. The print meant the world to me, yet it had never seemed at ease on my walls in America, where it looked like the cheapest kind of tourist gewgaw. I'd packed it with me on this journey, planning to restore it to the one place where I knew it was at home, the autoclave room. I looked over to Hema. Her face was aglow. She understood. What providence had brought us to this spot? Surely this was Gauche announcing his presence, because Gauche was the sort of man who could be counted on to know that Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa was minutes from our hotel, even if he'd never been to Rome before. Gauche had brought us here, led us to this spot, not to see St. Teresa in marble, but to see Sister Mary Joseph Praise in the flesh, for that is what the figure was to me. I have come, Mother. We lit candles. Hema fell to her knees, the flame throwing a flickering light on her face. Her lips moved. She believed in every kind of deity and in reincarnation and resurrection. She knew no contradictions in these areas. How I admired her faith, her lack of self-consciousness. A Hindu lighting candles to a Carmelite nun in a Catholic church. I knelt too. I addressed God and Sister Mary Joseph Praise and Shiva and Gauche, all the beings I carried with me in the flesh and in spirit. "Thank you for letting me be alive, letting me see this marble dream." I felt a great peace, a sense that coming to this spot had completed the circuit, and now a blocked current would flow and I could rest. If ecstasy meant the sudden intrusion of the sacred into the ordinary, then it had just happened to me. My mother had spoken. What I didn't know then was that she had more to say. Chapter 54. Home Fires. It was dusk when we landed. I had been away from Addis for 7 years. The white buildings of Missing looked rounded at the edges, worn down, as if they'd been excavated in an archaeological dig, but not restored. When the taxi reached Shiva's tool shed, I had the driver let me out. I told Hema to go on, because I wanted to walk the rest of the way. I stood listening once the car pulled away. The dry rustle of the leaves was like a child's hand sifting through a box of coins. The sound had lost all its menace for me. I found that dented and bent curb which had stopped a motorcycle but not its rider. I looked down into the trees and the shadows where he fell. The spot no longer generated any dread for me. All my ghosts had vanished. The retribution that they sought had been exacted. I had nothing more to give, and nothing to fear. I looked out over the trees to the city. The sky was a mad painter's canvas, as if halfway through the artist had decided against azure, and had instead splashed ochre and crimson and black on the palette. The city was alight, glowing, but here and there it was obscured by great puffs of mist which smudged my view, like the smoke of many small battles. I walked up the hill to the house. A thousand memories now of Shiva and me doing our three-legged race to be in time for dinner. Or the two of us and Gennett walking back with our schoolbooks, of Zamui coming up with his motorcycle and then coasting the last 100 yards. Up ahead, I could see the figures huddled around our taxi and around Hema. Then Matron, Gibru, and Almar separated from the vehicle, silhouetted against the last embers of the sky. And they waited for me. I'd been back just 3 days when Matron summoned me to casualty. A young girl with a bulgur wound to the abdomen was exsanguinating before our eyes. The child would have died if we'd tried to send her elsewhere. I took her to Operating Theatre 3 at once and found the bleeder. What followed next, cutting out damaged bowel, washing out the peritoneal cavity, fashioning a colostomy, was routine, but its effect on me was anything but. I felt I was on consecrated soil, standing on the same spot where Thomas Stone, Ghosh, and Shiva had stood, each with scalpel in hand. At the end of the surgery, when I turned to leave, weaving around the bucket and wires on the floor, I looked up and saw Shiva in the new glass that separated Theatre 3 from its spanking new mate, Theatre 4. The sight took my breath away. I remembered Shiva's first words when the killing of Cthulhu's puppies prompted him to break years of silence. "Will you forget if someone kills me, Omerion?" "No, Shiva, we'll never forget you," I said to my reflection. In saying that, I think I decided my future. Among Shiva's belongings in his room, I found a key on a keyholder shaped like the Congo. In Shiva's tool shed was a strange-looking motorcycle, with bright red stubby fenders, a teardrop-shaped red fuel tank, handlebars that would have been called ape hangers in America, and lovely chrome wheels. Hema said that Shiva had bought the bike second-hand a few years back, and that he kept tinkering with it. She said he had only ridden it late at night when there was no traffic. The udder-like engine looked very familiar, and its low rumble when I kick-started it gave away its true identity. I operated 3 days a week, and when my return ticket to New York was about to expire, I did nothing. Shiva's liver functioned beautifully in me year after year. The shots of hepatitis B immunoglobulin helped. The virus became so dormant that my blood tests showed I wasn't a carrier and that I couldn't infect anyone. Matron insisted it was a miracle, and I had to agree. In 1991, 5 years after my return, I stood by the gates of Missing, just as I had when I was a child, and I watched the forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front and other freedom fighters make their way into the city. They were dressed in the same functional shirts, shorts, and sandals of the guerrillas I had seen in Eritrea, bandoliers crisscrossing their chests, rifles in their hands. They didn't march in formation, yet their faces showed the discipline and confidence of men who believed in their cause. There was no looting, no mayhem. The only looting was by the Comrade President for Life, who emptied the treasury and fled with his loot to Zimbabwe, where his fellow looter, Mugabe, gave him refuge. Mengistu was a despised figure, a blight on the nation, a man about whom to this day no one can find a good word to say. Almaz said that the souls of all those he murdered were assembled in a stadium, waiting to give him a reception on his way to hell. Every evening I checked on Matron before I went to bed. She was so tremulous and bent over with age, but her joy in life was unchanged. We would have a cup of cocoa together. Her only LP, Bach, played in the background on the small gramophone I had bought for her. She never tired of the Gloria, which I will always associate with her. As I'd sit with her, she would look over and smile, as if she always knew I'd come back to the land I had once disowned. It had been Matron's wish that God might call her either during her prayers or her sleep, and he obliged. It was 1991, a few months after the President for Life fled. I found her in her chair, the record still spinning on her gramophone. Just the previous morning, she had been supervising the planting of a new cultivar, the Rosa rubiginosa Shiva, which she had officially registered with the Royal Society. To me, it looked as if the whole city, rich and poor, turned out for her funeral. Almaz said that the streets to heaven were lined by the souls of those who were grateful to Matron, and that her throne was next to Mary's. Almaz and Gibru were retired and ensconced in new, comfortable quarters built for them at Missing, free to spend their time in any way they chose. I suppose it should not have surprised me that they would spend it in fasting and prayer. The Shiva Stone Institute for Fistula Surgery, with Hema as its titular head, grew, as did its funding. Hema worked every day, and zealous young gynecologists from within the country, but also from other African nations, came to train and take up the cause. The staff probationer, whose room I had visited so many years ago, had become a skilled assistant under Shiva's tutelage, and now, with Hema's encouragement, she was a confident surgeon on her own, well suited to the painstaking task of training the young doctors who came to learn how to treat this one condition. I insisted on learning her real name, and reluctantly she told me it was Naima. But it was not a name she ever used. She had become the staff probationer even to herself. In going through Matron's papers, I discovered that the anonymous donor who had modestly funded Shiva's work for so many years was none other than Thomas Stone. Now he worked to direct other donors and foundations to support Missing. I had to wait till 2004 for Sister Mary Joseph Praise's message to reach me. It happened just after New Year's on the Western calendar, a time when the mimosa trees that surrounded the outpatient building had sprung their violet and yellow blooms and Missing was enveloped in the scent of vanilla. I'd gone into the autoclave room between patients. The framed print of Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa looked slightly askew. In straightening it, I found the hook was loose. When I took the frame down to tighten the hook, I noticed the thick paper backing had come unglued at one edge. The room stayed humid because of the autoclave, and it appeared to have weakened the glue. On trying to get the backing to stick again, I spied a gossamer-thin letter paper folded and ensconced behind that backing, the lines of blue writing showing through. I fished it out. I slumped back into my chair. My hands never tremble, but for some reason that delicate slip of paper shook. The letter looked discolored by age, almost transparent, in danger of crumbling into dust. Like Ghosh, I had a moment to decide whether to read a private letter that was meant for another. I was certain that this was the letter my mother had penned just before I was born. Then it was in Ghosh's possession. When I was 25 years old, the letter came to me. I had carried it to America, and then I had brought it back. For 25 years, I was unaware that I had it. Until today. "When are you coming, Mama?" I used to ask when I was a small boy, gazing up at the picture. She had come at last. Chapter 55. The Afterbird.
September 19th. Dear Thomas, last night God told me I must confess to you what I have never confessed even to God. Years ago, in Aden, I turned from God as He turned from me. Something happened to me there that should not happen to any woman. I could not forgive the man who harmed me. I could not forgive God. Death would have been better than what I endured. But I came here, to Missing. I came in the dress of a nun to hide my bitterness and shame from the world. In Jeremiah 17 it is written, "The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure, and who can understand it?" I came to Ethiopia in deceit. But our work changed me. I would have been your assistant till my last breath. Now things have changed again. A few months ago you were like a man possessed, and I tried to comfort you. Now I am with child. Do not blame yourself. It was difficult to hide my body from Matron and the others. Many times I thought of telling you. I could never find a way. But now I am frightened. My time is short. Last night the movements became strong. It made me think, what if Thomas wishes me to stay? I should not leave in the way I came to Missing and to you, hiding and in deceit. That is why I write. I must flee Missing to spare it my shame, just as I once fled to it to hide my shame. If you come to me when you get this letter, I will know that you wish me to be with you. But whatever you do, my love will always be the same. Mary.
It took such concentration to finish my last surgical case, a routine vagotomy and gastrojejunostomy for a duodenal ulcer, and not let my mind wander. At last, with that letter in hand, I walked back to my quarters, feeling as if I had never come up this path before.
She loved him. She loved him so much that she ran to him from Arden. The bloodstains with which she came to Missing told me what she could not. She made her way to the doctor, the man she had met on that ship out of India. And then, years later, she loved him so much she was ready to leave him. At the 11th hour, she decided to write and tell him. Then she waited for him to come, or not. But Thomas Stone did come. Surely she would have registered his arrival. As he picked her up, carried her, ran with her, every tear that fell from his eyes onto her face, she would have interpreted as affirmations of his love. He came not because of the letter, he never got it. He came because some part of him knew what he had done, and what he had to do. Some part of him knew what he felt. I pictured Ghosh visiting Thomas Stone's quarters after my mother's death, searching for him. He would have seen on Stone's desk the new textbook and bookmark, and on top of them, conspicuously perhaps, this letter. Thomas Stone never saw the book or the letter because he spent the previous night sleeping in the lounge chair in his Missing office, as he often did, and then after my mother's death he never returned to his quarters. Why hadn't Ghosh simply mailed the letter directly to Thomas Stone? Thomas never wrote or communicated. Ghosh had no address at first. But as the years went by, Ghosh could probably have found Stone's whereabouts. After all, Eli Harris had always known them. But perhaps by then, Ghosh was hurt by Stone's silence and his willingness to forget his old friend and leave him caring for his children as he ran from his past. As more years went by, Ghosh might have pondered the effect of the letter on Stone. Perhaps it would in fact be a disservice to send it to him. It might have precipitated another meltdown, or, as Hema had always feared, Stone might have returned to claim the children. And perhaps Stone wouldn't understand or believe anything the letter said. Then, as death approached, it must have worked on Ghosh's conscience to be the keeper of this letter. What if the contents could save Stone, put his heart at ease? What if it made Stone do, even belatedly, the right thing by his sons? By this time, all Ghosh's resentment for Stone, if he ever had any, had vanished. So ultimately, Ghosh gave the textbook and bookmark to Shiva, and the letter to me, but hidden from me.
I marveled at the foresight of a dying man who would entomb a letter within a framed picture. He would leave it to fate. How like Ghosh this was. When would I find Thomas Stone? When would I find the letter? If and when I found it, would I give the letter to its intended recipient? Ghosh trusted me to do whatever it is I would choose to do. That, too, is love. He'd been dead more than a quarter century, and he was still teaching me about the trust that comes only from true love. Shiva, I said, looking up at the sky where the stars were warming up for their nightly show, while I recalled the night I fled missing in haste, and how Shiva had thrust at me my father's book, A Short Practice, that bookmark inside. The few words on the bookmark penned by my mother were the only way any of us knew a letter even existed. Years ago, over the telephone, I had asked him, "Shiva, what made you give me the book?" He didn't know. "I wanted you to have it," was all he could say. The world turns on our every action and our every omission, whether we know it or not. When I reached my quarters, I sat down and spread the letter on my lap, and with shaky hands I dialed Thomas Stone's number. My father was well past 80 now, an emeritus professor. Deepak said the old man's eyes were fading, but his touch was so good he could have operated in the dark. Still, he rarely operated any more, though he would often assist. Thomas Stone was once known for the expedient operator, a short practice of tropical surgery. Now he was famous for pioneering a breakthrough transplant procedure. I was proof that the operation worked, but Shiva's death was proof of the attendant risks. Surgeons around the world had learned to do the operation, and many infants born without a working bile drainage system had been saved by a parent's gift of a part of his or her liver. In my earpiece, I heard the hush of the void that hangs over the earth. And then, out of that ether, the sound of the phone ringing far away, its high-pitched summons so brisk and efficient, so different from the lackadaisical analog clicks and the coarse ring when I dialed an Addis Ababa number. I pictured the phone trill and echo in the apartment that I had visited once, and which I had left open like a sardine can so that Thomas Stone would know that his son had arrived in his world. I thought of my mother writing this letter, her whole life compressed on one side of this parchment. She had probably delivered it, and the book with bookmark, in the late afternoon when the pains hit her. She had worsened in the night, slowly slipping into shock, and then the next day she died. But not before Thomas Stone came to her. It was the sign she had waited for. He did the right thing, and yet for the last half century he was unaware that he had done so. Thomas Stone answered after the first ring. It made me wonder if he were wide awake, even though it was the middle of the night in Boston.
"Yes?"
My father's voice was crisp and alert, as if he expected this intrusion, as if he were ready for the story of trauma or massive brain bleed that made an organ available, or ready to hear of a child, 1 in 10,000, born with biliary atresia who would die without a liver transplant. The voice I heard was that of someone who would bring all the skill and experience he carried in his 9 fingers to the rescue of a fellow human being, and who would pass on that legacy to another generation of interns and residents. It was what he was born to do. He knew nothing else.
"Stone here," he said,
his voice sounding so very close, as if he were there with me, as if nothing at all separated our 2 worlds.
This is Sunil Malhotra. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. This program was produced and directed by Sean Runette. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by Abraham Verghese. Production copyright 2009, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.